And while you're getting settled, I will reintroduce the panel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. My name is Kayala Eid. I'm serving as presiding judge today. I'm joined by Judge Bentley and Judge Kirk. This is the last of four arguments on our oral argument calendar today. This is 824-1236, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Midwest Car Search, LLC, et al. Appellants. Counsel for appellants will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel respondent will have 15 minutes. There's a switch on the front of the podium you can use to adjust the podium up and down to your comfort level. There's a recording being made of this proceeding. It'll be available on our website later this afternoon or tomorrow. That's the only recording to be made of the proceeding. We are also streaming live on Zoom or on our website. And when you begin, counsel, please identify yourself and who you represent. And with that, counsel for appellants, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Aaron Thome. I represent the appellants, Midwest Car Search, LLC, and Scott Spixa. My clients are a small Minnesota business, a small used car dealership, and my client has every intention of complying with every law in the books. And it's a complicated industry. There's a lot to comply with. But he's made it a practice. He's been in business since 2004 and has done everything that he can to comply with the law over time. And this case is no exception. There's been an investigation going on since the end of 2022. It's been a slow-moving investigation, but at every step of the investigation, my client has been interested in working with the state to the extent the state wants practices to be identified or modified. He's been willing to engage in those discussions and has consistently engaged in those discussions. So much so that prior to the initiation of this litigation, the state approached my client with some practices that it preferred my client implement, and my client agreed without question, no hesitation, said, yes, absolutely, we'll do that. The state, however, has looked everywhere it can to try to reach for allegations of violations, and it asserts everything that it possibly can against my client.
Counsel, those assertions are backed up by affidavits and the like, aren't they?
There's a lot of disputes, Your Honor, regarding the violations. The state will tell you that it has a slam dunk case, that it's got all these violations, that it has my client dead to rights. There's two sides to that story. Unfortunately, the second side to the story didn't really get told. It is briefed below, but I'll get into that now. What we're here for today is an injunction that the state drafted almost without modification from the district court. There are some minor modifications, but it was drafted by the state. It says that this is based on the submissions of the state. It wasn't based on the submissions of the defendants. There are a lot of disputes of fact and a lot of disputes of law that were raised below, but the only side of the story that was told was the state's side of the story. Now, the injunction provisions that were drafted contain no findings. There are no specific practices identified, for example, that are a violation of the law. It simply says there is good cause to believe that the state is likely to succeed on one or more of its claims, incorporating a convoluted, confusing Dahlberg analysis where Wadena implement applies, but also not saying, here's why. Here's the factual findings that support issuance of injunctive relief. As Rule 6504 and 5201 specifically require.
Can I ask you a quick question about that, the kind of review that we're applying or the test, you know, that would justify a temporary injunction? So this is temporary injunction, right? So it necessarily kind of comes early in the case. The court hasn't decided actual liability yet. Do you agree that at least the likelihood of success on the merits piece is the appropriate standard, that the court doesn't have to have already established a violation of a statute for the temporary injunction, right?
Your Honor, the substantial likelihood of success on the merits or likelihood of success on the merits is under the Dahlberg test, which is equitable, and here the state was seeking a statutory injunction. So the likelihood of success on the merits does not apply here. The state needed to show...
But, I mean, we have cases, I think, that have applied the cross-country bank case was a temporary injunction case where the court had found a likelihood of success on the merits. So, I mean, as I understand it, you know, we don't have to apply all five factors of Dahlberg, but that with respect to whether there was an actual violation established at the temporary stage, that likelihood of success kind of naturally is the question that the court's presented with.
Your Honor, the problem with Cross Country Bank is that in that case, the district court applied Dahlberg in the context of a statutory injunction. That was not correct, but it wasn't challenged. So it's not correct. It's not the correct standard.
So is it your view that the court at a temporary has to have already established a statutory violation? It almost seems like you couldn't have a temporary injunction then.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Yes, the issue is that there needs to be a showing of a violation or a threatened violation. That's literally what the statute says. But that's not really the problem here. The problem here is that we're talking about an injunction. Injunctions, by definition, or by their very nature, are forward-looking. Well, here, what the state has said, they've admitted that it's not a forward-looking injunction. They acknowledge that my client has implemented all of the specific preferred practices that they wanted. But what they say is, well, we think that we have a likelihood of success on the merits of establishing a violation, and therefore we can get punitive, backward-looking injunctive relief.
But is that true? I mean, I know at the hearing, I don't know if you were counsel for the district court. I'm sorry, I didn't remember that. But I know there was some dispute between the hearing occurring in July and there being evidence in the affidavits of a violation occurring in May. And so, I mean, is it really true that this is a backward-only looking injunction? I mean, I think from the state's perspective, as of the time of the hearing, these were ongoing violations, and there was no assurance that your client was going to voluntarily comply with the terms of the injunction.
That's exactly what we'd like findings on. And we'd like an evidentiary hearing. We would like the district court to make findings on that point, Your Honor. Because the state will come up here and they'll tell you, oh, there's ongoing violations. They'll assert that to Your Honor, but they won't be able to support it with evidence. We never got to tell our side of the story. We never got to show the district court our compliance. It was just the state saying, we've shown a violation at some point in the distant past, and that's all you need. You don't need ongoing violations. That's been their argument consistently. You don't need ongoing violations. You don't need to show that. Well, 8.31 subdivision 3 specifically says the court only has jurisdiction to issue injunctive relief to prevent or restrain violations. That means there needs to be a violation on the horizon. There needs to be a threatened
violation.
You're
reading that. I mean, this is, I think, along the lines of what the district court was asking you at this hearing is, I mean, does the state need to walk into the courtroom on the day of the hearing with video of your client violating the law the day of the hearing?
No.
How closely, I mean, the state had submitted evidence from May, and the hearing occurred in July.
Your Honor, the issue here is not whether or not the state is able to meet up to establish some violation. That's not the problem. That's not the error. That's not the issue that we're here today to talk about. The issue is the language of the injunctive relief that the state procured. So
it seems like you're pivoting from that. I mean, we can talk about the language. Your argument is that the injunction is a comply with the law injunction.
That's one issue with it. It's a comply with the law injunction. There are provisions that simply say comply with Minnesota Statute 325F.662, various subdivisions. And that is, by definition, a comply with the law injunction, which, as a general matter, is not enforceable.
Well, it doesn't end there, though, right? I mean, it cites the statute and then specifically says in relation to a specific sales practice and gives further guidance about providing information in writing, in Spanish,
It says comply with the statute and then it has more language. And is a conjunctive term. So the state could find any violation of the statute, regardless of whether it's related to the language that follows the word and the state could assert that that is a violation of the injunction and attempt to get my client in contempt because of that under the injunction. And that is just the drafting of the injunction. My client has every intention of complying with the law and with any order that issues. But he can't understand, and I can't counsel my client with respect to these various issues that are disputed issues of law and disputed issues of fact. And we've put some of that in our briefing. We briefed it below. The district court didn't make determinations on these disputes. So when the state gets an injunction that says you need to comply with the law, we need to know what that means. Injunctions are targeted at practices. If my client is committing a practice that violates the law, that can be specified and it can be enjoined. That's what an injunction does. But to simply say comply with the law, as the numerous authorities that we've cited in our briefing hold, that's not a permissible injunction. And it's particularly problematic here where we have so many arguments regarding the law and regarding the facts. One of the injunctive provisions says you're prohibited from making material misrepresentations of fact. The state makes many arguments about what my client has done, claiming that my client has made material misrepresentations of fact. We countered that, showing that my client has made truthful disclosures and accurate disclosures. The issue here for this court is not who's right on that question. The issue is that there needs to be some determination so that my client knows what he is allowed to do so that he can operate his business. Otherwise, he does not know how to operate. There's another provision that's troubling, beyond the comply with the law provisions, that my client is required to provide all documents in connection with its sales of used motor vehicles in Spanish, if a sale is conducted in Spanish. That phrase, in connection with its sales of used motor vehicles, is hopelessly broad. That includes literally every single document at my client's dealership.
But it only involves those sales that are conducted in Spanish.
It does. But if a sale is conducted in Spanish, what is my client to furnish? Every single document that at the dealership in Spanish, that would include messages to vendors, text messages between salespeople. It would even include documents that the state requires to be utilized that the state only makes available in English and that the state only accepts in English from my client. There is a document that's required to be provided in Spanish when a sale is conducted in Spanish. It's the buyer's guide. It's clear under the law, under Minnesota law incorporating the Code of Federal Regulations. That document could be ordered to be provided in Spanish. My client does provide that document to clients in Spanish when a sale is conducted in Spanish. To order more than that exceeds what Minnesota law requires and therefore exceeds the court's authorization.
Doesn't that the word provide reasonably imply that it means of documents you provide to the buyer? It's not saying you have to provide to any and everyone. I mean, the idea is in connection with sales. So as I read it, it applies to documents that you provide in the sale to the buyer. Or is that not a reasonable reading of that?
The issue, Your Honor, is that literally, if you read the words literally, it says provide all documents in connection with its sales of used motor vehicles in Spanish. Now, the reason that injunctions need to be specific in their terms is because we don't simply say what's a reasonable interpretation of that. Because the state could take an interpretation of that tomorrow that says this was a document that was not provided to us in connection with the sale to a customer when a deal was conducted in Spanish. And they could identify any document and say, this document related to the sale of a vehicle.
So, but with that type of issue of, you know, confusion to the extent that the client is genuinely confused about what falls within that provision, why didn't you or couldn't you go to the district court to clarify that?
We raised this issue with the district court specifically in the hearing. We said this would apply to all the documents in the dealership. We don't have clarity as to what this means. What's the limit of this? But the district court didn't do anything with respect to that argument. Signed the state's order as it was drafted. And so we're raising it here because it is not clear. So, you know, to sum up, the real issues here are that we need findings. We need findings of fact. We need the law applied to the facts here with respect to specific practices.
Did you ask for an evidentiary hearing?
We did.
And the district court denied your request?
Yes.
And just ruled on the papers? And the affidavits?
And an oral argument.
And an oral argument. And you submitted countervailing affidavits?
Yes, we did. But again, because the proposed order was drafted by the state and it went into the district court, signed it with very limited modification, our submissions didn't come into
that
document.
The counter to that is that the district court wasn't persuaded by what you submitted, right? I mean, one inference is the district court didn't consider it, but the other is that the district court rejected it, right?
That's true, except that the document literally says that it considered the submissions of the state. It doesn't say that it considered the submissions of the defendants. And typically what you see in an order is, here is the dispute, and here is my conclusion. There are no actual factual findings here. There are conclusions of law, and they're labeled conclusions of law. And then there's an order provision. But there's not a findings of fact section.
Well, the sentence ends, and the affidavits and declarations submitted to the court.
Sure.
Which would include what you submitted, right?
I don't know. There's no reference to it, and there's no reference to the substance of it within that document. Also, the document was submitted to the court before we made any submissions to the court. So,
proposed order was submitted.
Yeah, the proposed order. Right. Yes, correct, Your Honor. And I see that I'm out of time. I'm happy to answer any additional questions, or else I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Alex Baldwin on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. Today's appeal presents the court with a straightforward path to affirm for three reasons. First, the district court did not clearly err in finding that appellants engaged in five distinct forms of conduct. The state submitted a voluminous record of appellant's fraud. This included documents obtained from appellant's business records, their admissions in pre-complaint discovery, business documents obtained from appellant's business partners, public-facing advertisements, and the sworn statements of 15 victims. In response, appellants admitted to the underlying facts comprising three of the state's claims and did not contest the factual record on the other two claims. On this record, in response to a voluminous and either admitted to or unopposed record, the district court did not clearly err in issuing those five key findings at page 3, paragraph 6 of its order. Second, the district court did not clearly err in finding that issuing a temporary injunction would fulfill the legislative purpose behind Minnesota's consumer protection statutes by protecting consumers from further harm during the pendency of this case. Finally, the district court applied the correct standard and did not clearly err in finding that there is good cause to believe that the state will likely prevail on the merits of its claims. This court's 2005 cross-country bank decision held that when the state seeks a statutory temporary injunction under Section 8.31, the injunction shall be granted if the prerequisites for injunctive relief have been shown and the injunction will fulfill the legislature's purpose in enacting the statute. In cross country, this court held that the district court's findings of likely success on the merits is, quote, satisfies the requirement of a sufficient showing of prerequisites for the statutory injunction have been demonstrated. That's 703 Northwest 2nd at 574. None of the arguments appellants advance demonstrate any legal error, and they do not come remotely close to demonstrating that the district court abused its considerable discretion. I want to turn to actually the fourth argument that appellants raised, that the district court exceeded its authority. Appellants take issue with two injunctive provisions that they assert go beyond the used car law. You know, as a threshold matter here, appellant's argument is premised on the idea that the district court is confined to only outlawing specific conduct prohibited by statute, which to me sounds a lot like saying the district court is only permitted to issue obey the law injunctions, in direct contradiction to their position elsewhere. Appellants cite no case law, no rule, no statute, no treatise for their bold claim that the court is only permitted to enjoin precisely what a statute prohibits.
Does it implicate equitable injunction if it goes beyond? I mean, I appreciate your first argument there, but does it implicate equitable jurisdiction or the court's equitable authority to go beyond what's contemplated strictly by each of the statutes?
Not in this case, because appellant's focus is entirely on the used car law. They ignore that we brought claims under the False Statement and Advertising Act, the Consumer Fraud Act, and the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And so if you look at the two issues that they identified, the first one that they cannot advertise vehicles as certified at all, even if they comply with the statutory requirements, that is supported by the False Statement and Advertising Act, the Consumer Fraud Act, and the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Likewise, their objection to providing all documents, all sales documents that are provided to consumers in Spanish, that again is targeted at appellant's deceptive bait and switch scheme, in which they falsely advertise in Spanish, they lie to people at the dealership in Spanish, and then when it comes time to sign the documents, they say something different in English. That's a deceptive trade practice. So all of the relief that the district court ordered can be traced back to those three statutes in addition to the used car law. I was going to, you know, explain the sort of the fencing in doctrine, and I do think that's also not invoking equitable concerns. I mean, courts that have interpreted the FTC Act, which our Minnesota Supreme Court in the 2019 School of Business case has said is persuasive authority, you know, we've got the Supreme Court, we've got Eighth Circuit, we've got other circuit court cases saying you're permitted to fence in a defendant's unlawful activity. You don't need to be confined to the precise form of what it is that violated the law, as long as it's reasonably related, for the obvious reason you don't want the defendant to tweak their practice and continue to defraud people but be outside the scope of the injunction.
Does it matter that the Minnesota School of Business case was a permanent injunction?
I'm referring to the 2019, in which they discussed the rationale for why case law interpreting FTC enforcement actions are appropriate because of the Attorney General scheme is correct. The Minnesota School of Business case that dealt with permanent injunctions is the 2017 Minnesota Supreme Court case.
Thank you.
Can you address the argument just looking at the provision that they're supposed to provide all documents in connection with sales in Spanish, is, you know, that the idea that that may encompass every document, I mean, everything they do involves the sales of used motor vehicles. That's the purpose of the business. Why isn't that kind of an overly broad or vague injunctive provision?
So, first of all, I think as we've noted, it refers to the sales process. And it also uses the word provide, as you noted. We're referring to information here that is provided to a consumer, that is consumer-facing, that is related to the bait-and-switch scheme in which there's, you know, big promises in Spanish that are lies, and then you find the documents that are different. So the idea that it applies to, like, the vehicle registration or text messages between people, I think were the examples I heard, I don't think that's a reasonable reading of the plain language at all. And again, this was one of the things that at oral argument, the district court was specifically concerned with this bait and switch scheme, noted that this is an expensive purchase for people and that they should be required to provide more than just the buyer's guide, which is required by law in Spanish, but, you know, the information that a consumer is, in fact, looking at. Turning to the argument that they make about the injunctive provisions are imprecise or vague, kind of obey the law, I think as the court has noted here, the statutory citations that appear in two provisions are useless. You could strike those from it and it would not change the injunction, because what follows the word and is the entire conduct encompassed by those statutory provisions. So for example, paragraph 7, which is about warranties, this is what those provisions require. A warranty in writing covers the correct parts and duration and honor the warranty. That's what the statute requires. There's nothing else. I think this is referred to as complex provisions, large and sundry swaths of statutory provisions, limitless breadth. I mean, these arguments are beyond disingenuous. It's three things.
I think that maybe, as I understand their argument, is that because this is early stages of litigation, the court hasn't reached the merits yet. It has looked at and decided that maybe there's a likelihood of success, but hasn't considered all of their arguments. And there are certain statements that they maintain weren't false, that you may disagree with or the state may disagree with. And those haven't been determined by the court yet. So in the meantime, if they don't think that that's a false statement, are they prohibited by the injunction from making it? So how are they? I think, you know, that's part of the question about this, which is dealing with the kind of temporary nature or the substantial likelihood. How do you navigate that? How do they have to navigate that?
Yeah, and just, I mean, as it relates to specifically, like, obey the law injunctions, again, the only two provisions that have a statutory cite, paragraph 7 and 8, everything is spelled out, so I think those concerns wouldn't apply. You know, as we're talking about paragraph 2, the no false statements, again, there's a few things. First of all, it's for the district court to decide what a material false statement is or a material omission. It's not for the state, I think. Second of all, we're talking, and again, the reason why this one, for example, is not a comply with the law injunction is when you look at, like, this Consumer Fraud Act, for example, it says don't use any false pretenses, don't use any unfair or unconscionable practices. And while that is defined in the case law and there's guidance from it, those are, I admit, broad terms, but that's not what the injunction said. It's just limited to false statements. And I don't think there's any dispute here about something that they say is false or not. I mean, they admitted in a pre-complaint interrogatory answer that they did not properly advertise vehicles as certified. And then they admitted in the SPCSA affidavit that was provided in opposition to this motion, said, historically, we did not give consumers inspection reports, which is a necessary but sufficient condition to market or sell a vehicle as certified. So I don't think there's any validity or I think even really argument that what is being alleged is false, literally false, is true, is in fact true. Because again, the statutes that we're after do go after far more than just false statements, which is what we will attempt to prove at trial. But the injunction is just limited to material false statements.
Can I ask you the paragraph 8? I can see what you're saying about paragraph 7, because actually in each of the enumerated, you know, parentheticals that follow the statutory citation, all of the statutory subdivisions are captured by the end of that sentence. But in paragraph 8, you know, it doesn't specifically reference in the end. So to your counterpart's point, you know, 325F.662 subdivision 6 points the reader to go to the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 16, Part 445. And I don't admittedly have that at my fingertips, but presumably the used motor vehicle trade regulation rule might encompass more than just what's enumerated in the paragraphs of the injunction. So to his point about that being there's a conjunction of and between the beginning of that sentence and the rest of it, why is this not a follow the law, that first part of the sentence, a follow the law type injunction that doesn't give him fair notice of what he needs to advise his client not to do?
Because those five provisions are the only five provisions that the state has alleged that appellants have violated of the used car rule.
And so he's to understand that when what follows the statutory citation is limited to just the ways that 325F.662 subdivision 6 applies to the allegations?
Yes.
Would you agree it would have been perhaps preferable to, instead of use the word and, replace that with in these respects?
In these respects, by, it could have been left out entirely. All of those, I think, would have been fine, but I think as written, it is not clearly erroneous and can be affirmed. But I agree, there can always change the language that's issued. I do want to briefly address the issue of the, you know, argument I heard about the injunction not fulfilling the legislative purpose of the, you know, Minnesota's consumer protection statutes. You know, they say that it must show that it's necessary to restrain a violation. There's no legal authority for that position. Cross Country Bank is clear that there needs to be no demonstration of ongoing or likely to recur conduct. The district court referred to this statutory framework of 8.31 as a hammer, that you can use a past violation to ensure future compliance. And the district court used its hammer here. The most effective way to restrain and prevent violations during the pendency of this case is to restrain them during the pendency of the case. And I think it's also important to note, too, that the district court did not make any finding that the ongoing, that the conduct has stopped and, in fact, was troubled by the ongoing false representations about their vehicles being certified close to the time of the oral argument.
That was the May violation that was referenced at the hearing?
Correct. You know, again, there's no indication from the order that the court found that the violations have stopped, but even if they did, it's irrelevant under 8.31 Cross Country Bank and all of the cases we cited. You can use a past violation to ensure future compliance. And again, I think I heard the issue that there was no fact findings. I mean, paragraph 6, page 3 of the order gives the 5 key findings. You know, there's this argument I think I heard that there were two sides to the story, or, you know, it wasn't told. There wasn't two sides to the story because it did not contest the facts. They admitted to some of them. And their request for an evidentiary hearing was made in a footnote in their opposition memorandum. Wadena says that it's within the district court's discretion to not hold an evidentiary hearing, and Rule 6502 says it may be, you may hold an evidentiary hearing, but you may grant a temporary injunction on the basis of affidavits. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you.
I say I'm out of time.
Now, to address the point of what's authorized under the statute, 8.31 subdivision 3 is the state's authority for seeking this injunction, and that allows or provides jurisdiction to the district court to issue an injunction to prohibit or restrain violations of law. It does not allow anything beyond that. Your Honor's correct that that would require equitable analysis, that would require a Dahlberg factor weighing, and that was obviously not done here. Now, with respect to what the state is now for the first time referring to as a bait and switch, I don't know what the state's referring to, but it says that the reason that all documents must be provided is a result of a bait and switch. Well, the problem is the state is limiting the language of that today to say something that the language does not say. The state is saying that documents need to be provided to consumers, and I don't even understand what the state is saying needs to be provided. I'm even more confused now than I was going into this, because I'm looking at the plain language of paragraph 9 of the order provision, and it says, defendants shall provide all documents in connection with its sales of used motor vehicles to consumers, Minnesota consumers, in Spanish when the sale is conducted in Spanish or upon request. All documents in connection with its sales of used motor vehicles. It doesn't say when a sale occurs, each of the documents provided to the consumer in conjunction with that sale must be provided in Spanish. It literally doesn't say that. But that's what the state is telling us today. But talk about a bait and switch. The state's giving us one reading today, and tomorrow the state could seek to enforce this according to its plain language, meaning if there was a text message sent, that is a document that is in connection with its sales of used motor vehicles. If that's not translated into Spanish and provided to a consumer, if a sale is conducted in Spanish, contempt. That's why injunction provisions need to be clear. This is not clear, as the state's equivocation and attempt to rewrite it today tells us. Now, I heard with respect to each of these provisions where...
But isn't a bigger problem with that argument that we also have to agree with you that that's an overreach to require a text message in connection? I mean, this was the point, right, of the debate that you had at the hearing, right? I mean, the district court judge analogized this to criminal proceedings where everything is provided to a criminal defendant in their preferred language or that they understand. So, I mean, what is your response to their argument that given the panoply of statutes that they cited, everything, even given its breadth, is within the power of the Attorney General to seek and the court to order? As part of this injunction?
There's two problems. There's an authority issue, which the authority that the district court has is to enjoin violations. A violation is not providing a buyer's guide in Spanish. That's the only document that Minnesota law requires be provided in Spanish. That is within the district court's authority. Anything beyond that exceeds the district court's authority.
But the bait and switch that he was referring to, right, is that sales are conducted in Spanish and then over the phone, and then someone comes to the used car lot. More Spanish is spoken, and then when they get to actually buy, everything is provided in English, and there is something deceptive in the document. So that's Deceptive Trade Practices Act. It was his argument. So why wouldn't that be encompassed within that?
If that's an issue, so going beyond the authority issue, if an issue is that particular documents aren't being provided in Spanish and the state seeks to have those provided in Spanish, it needs to identify those documents. So that my client knows what to have translated and what to provide. There are even documents generated by the state that are not translated into Spanish, and there's just no clarity as to what this requires. I'm not disagreeing with Your Honor that we could sit here and enumerate documents that need to be provided in Spanish. That could be done. That's literally not what this provision does. And moving on to the parts of that are simply comply with the law provisions, today, the state is saying you could strike that language. You can't just say you can just strike language. I mean, you're not to read a provision as mere surplusage, but that's what the state is telling us to do here. We don't know what that language means, particularly because the state is now saying it's meaningless. You should rewrite it. You should read that out of the injunction. That's just nothing but confusion. And same issue with respect to the material false statements. The state argued it's for the district court to decide what a material false statement is. That's completely backwards. If the state had false statements it was seeking to enjoin, it needed to identify those and say, here's what you can't do. And then my client knows what it can't do. So as I see I'm out of time, as the state's arguments today make clear, this language is completely imprecise. My client has no guidance as to how to follow it. My client has every intention of following the law and any injunction that issues, but this one simply needs to be vacated. And for those reasons, we respectfully ask that your honors reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your helpful arguments. The matter is submitted. We'll issue a decision in the statutory time frame. That concludes our oral argument calendar for the day. We are in recess.